Good afternoon, Wilkinson here. Today, my guest is Bill Cavanaugh, and he has a new book coming out early next year. So first of all, say hi, Bill.
Hello there. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. We met, I don't know, what, a week or two ago? I was doing a photo shoot for him, and he needed some headshots for some of his business stuff. So I helped him with that, and we got chatting. I learned he's writing a book, and he's got an interesting story. And I said, oh, let's do a podcast. He goes, sure, let's do it. So tell us a little about your book coming out. What's it about?
The title of the book is Keep Your Fork, Something Sweet is Coming. And it's about how traumas in our life can end up being the greatest gifts that we could be given as long as we choose to see them that way. It's difficult sometimes when they're handed to us in some pretty shitty wrapping paper, but eventually, if we choose to, they can end up being some of our greatest gifts.
So do you tell how to make shitty stuff into lemonade what's the approach?
Well,
I
always say if life hands you lemons, why do something as boring as lemonade?
So what do you want to make with it? Some other delicious dessert?
Most of it comes
dessert?
From my own personal stories and the challenges that I've overcome, because I figured that unless I put those in there, it didn't really show that I was an expert at it, except that I had overcome them myself.
And so you are coming from the position of being a therapist, correct?
Yes.
Talk a little about that.
Well, I always say when you write, I'm a psychotherapist, but when you write it down, make sure you don't have any spaces, because otherwise it comes out as psycho the rapist. I am a therapist. It's one of the gifts that came from one of my challenges was about 12 years ago, I decided to go back to school and get my master's in psychology and be able to help people who were going through struggles.
How's that worked out?
Hopefully I've helped a few.
I'm sure you have. So what were you doing before that? I guess I should ask that first.
The rest of my life, I was an entertainment producer. I had my own production company, and then I worked for Dick Clark for a little while. I worked for Walt Disney Company, and then I produced ceremonies for two Olympics.
Wow. And what was the time span on that? Of the whole entertainment thing.
Yeah. Oh, the whole entertainment thing. Well, my degree was in graphic design. So I started out as an artist in Dallas, Texas for an entertainment company. Became a producer for them and then left and started my own company. So that began back in the 1800s at some point.
Come on. 1800s, come on. Did you just get burnout doing that or what? What was the...
The impetus was, there was a period when I was working for a production company up in San Francisco and got laid off from that company. And I've always said that unemployment is one of the most difficult things that anybody can go through. It's the uncertainty that gets it. I was also starting to have some pains when I was first laid off, and it ended up being stage 4 cancer when they eventually found it. And I always say the uncertainty of not knowing is worse than the cancer. And it's the same thing for unemployment. I also say that unemployment is worse than cancer, because when you have cancer and you're going through treatment, you do what the doctors tell you and you have a set regimen and you do the routine and you know how you're going to feel in a few days and everybody loves you and you've got all these people there to support you.
Right.
But when you're uncertain and you're sick and you don't know what it is or you're unemployed, that is one of the worst things to have to go through.
So that caused you. So wait a minute, I'm trying to get the timeline here. So entertainment, cancer, unemployment, therapy.
I'll tell you what happened.
Put it in a timeline for me here.
It was Christmas Eve of 2007 when the oncologist told me I had stage 4 cancer.
Okay.
And the first thing I said to him was, gee, I'm sorry I didn't get you anything for Christmas.
And wow.
And then I said, I'll be anxious to find out what the gift is in this, because I'm a true believer that our worst traumas become our greatest gifts. And he started to cry.
Wow.
And he said, I know that because I've worked with so many people with cancer, but no one has ever said that on the day of diagnosis before.
Wow.
And that made me realize that it was the truth, and that someday I was going to find, if I survived it,
right,
what the purpose for it was. And I can tell you that year of going through chemotherapy was people always laugh when I say it was the happiest year of my life when I had cancer. But so many people stepped up to help me, and I made it fun. For anyone who took me to chemotherapy, they had to wear a costume and perform for the doctors. And I wrote scripts and songs, and everybody,
I'm glad I was not your driver.
Most people said, I don't know if I want to take you to chemo after all, but it was the producer in me that turned it into a show. And I have so many great pictures. I scrapbooked the whole year. So many great pictures of people in my chemo sessions dancing for the nurses. And one day, one of them, she was a drunk Disney princess. She was dressed up as, and she was hysterical. And a nurse knocked on the door and came in and said, "What are people going to think that you're in here laughing so hard?" And my friend, the princess, said, "They're going to think that some people laugh no matter what." And for a while, that was going to be the title of my book, is Laugh No Matter What.
Okay.
Because that day, she was so profound when she said that. Some people laugh no matter what.
And of course, laughing is healing in itself.
Oh, laughter is the greatest medicine there is.
Right.
It's a big part of my book.
So tell us more about the book.
There's a lot of other stories. There's the...
No, I'm going to interrupt you here, but okay. I get that you want people to buy the book when it comes out. So you can do it in a teasing format where they're going to want to buy the book. How about that? Tell us enough to,
that's putting me on the
spot, make us want to do it.
Well, it's for anyone who... Part of the reason for the title of Keep Your Fork is if you're at a fork in the road, or you're sitting on the fence and you don't know how to make a step forward, there are a lot of exercises in the book that you can take to help you create your future, sometimes based on your past. What you've been through is the greatest seeds to plant for what your future can be. There are a lot of different exercises in the book that you can take to help you move forward. Right after cancer, I started a company with a friend of mine who is a Broadway performer, and the company was called Next, and it was for people who wanted to take the next step in life. Very often people who were retiring and didn't know what they wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so we traveled around the country with this seminar, and we got up on stage and performed and came up with so many different kinds of questions to ask yourself on how do I move forward in life? And so that's a big part of the book too, is once you've overcome a challenge, how do I move forward? How do I learn from it and move forward? And again, a big part of it is based on my experience and the things that I've been through, other than cancer as well.
Right. So if someone wanted to write a book, how do you find a publisher? How do you do that?
Oh, it's not easy.
Because we all think about, I want to write my story. I want to write a book someday. Everybody thinks that. So, but you did it.
I started writing it 10 years ago and researched many, many, many books. And there's a lot of quotes in the book from other authors. Once I had finished the book, it took me 2 years to find an agent. I submitted the book to 125 different agents before one of them accepted it. She's a wonderful woman in Chicago. And she's been working for 2 years to find a publisher. And we finally got a publisher just last month. So,
wow.
Yes.
And very excited. When will it actually be published?
April 25th of next year, 2023.
And you're in the editing process now, you said?
Editing and designing the cover. And I got a great headshot last week from someone.
Oh, I wonder who did that. That'll be fun. So what was the most difficult part in that whole process that you just described?
I'll tell you, to be honest, I wrote the book as a self-help book. And I paid an editor to read it. And she said, "You don't have any of your own stories in there. And nothing would make you look like an expert, not from your degrees or your license, but nothing would make you look more like an expert than your own personal experience. And so you need to put your stories in there." So I put my stories in there. Then I had another editor read it and say, "I think a little bit too much about you." So it was a real balance of...
Well, why didn't you take it back to the first one? As though she'd like what you did.
Well, I thought I'd try somebody else who, you know, get two different sides to it. But it's not easy being vulnerable and telling, you know, the struggles of being a gay child and
being... Oh, wait, you're gay?
Yes, I am.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But being bullied, there was one incident of being bullied that happened when I was 14. that also changed my life. And that's a big part of the opening of the book.
Can you talk a little about that?
I was an artist. I was a creative kid, and walking to art class across the basketball court where all these boys were playing basketball. And by the way, my father was a basketball player for Ohio State, so he would have loved to me have me be playing on the basketball court. But right. I always joke that I did get a blue ribbon at the state fair for my basket of balls of petunias, but that's I misinterpreted baskets and balls in a different way. But anyhow, I was walking across the basketball court on my way to art class, and they grabbed all my art supplies and were throwing them all over the ground and pushing me back and forth and shoving me back and forth and calling me a loser. And it hurt because my father had three words that we were never allowed to use in our house. And that was fool, stupid, and loser. Mm-hmm. Because he said, no one is a fool, no one is stupid, and no one is a loser. So we were never allowed to use those words. And so to be called that hurt so much because I thought that they were right. And indeed, I was a loser. I was just this artist and not a basketball player like they were. And they all ran off, and I sat there on the basketball. Can't tell this without crying. I sat there on the basketball court with tears in my eyes, and I looked up at the sky. And I know this sounds like the most dramatic thing ever, but I looked up at the sky and I said, this will be the hardest day of my life. And because I've never forgotten it, I truly believe that it's still the truth. And that anytime I've gone through something like cancer or addiction or any of those, I remember thinking, this is not the hardest day of my life. That was back then was. And as dramatic as it sounds, and anytime I tell a friend, they always say, oh my God, that's so drama queen. But I still truly believe it. But what it was saying to me when I said that was the hope that life was going to get better. And I can't tell you what those bullies taught me. They taught me courage and compassion. And when I say courage, it's I wasn't afraid to get the hell out of London, Ohio when I graduated. The other thing that I did that I thought was kind of brilliant was I became editor of the yearbook. And so if you wanted to be flattered in the yearbook, you better be nice to me.
Well, so that was pretty genius.
Anyhow, so many incredible lessons that I learned from them.
Were the bullies in there?
In the yearbook?
Yeah.
If they were nice to me, they were in there in a good way.
Really? So they could be nice to you, right?
They ended up being. Actually, some of them I'm still in touch with. They seem to have forgotten that day. But
wow. You couldn't remind them? Or is it pointless?
No, it would actually. If I went back for a reunion, that would be kind of a good story. Maybe. Maybe not. Still sounds dramatic.
Well, it is. So you mentioned you're gay. So how did that unfold in your life? Or did you know you were gay when you were 14 sitting on the basketball court?
All I knew is that I was different. I knew that I held secrets. And I always say, whenever I speak at 12-step meetings, I always say that our biggest addiction is secrets. And the more we try to look perfect, the more secrets we're hiding because no one's perfect. Mm. And so I knew I had a lot of secrets, but they were also secrets to me. Another big trauma that I went through was my mother died when I was 6. Mm. And she was my everything. I mean, I was talk about a mama's boy. That was me. She was my everything. And she died very suddenly on Christmas. Oh, Christmas Eve. Another Christmas Eves aren't so good for me.
Wow.
And she died very suddenly. And so that was a secret that I held. And this is an interesting story too, is a few months before she died, she took me to the store and we bought lilac seeds. And she said, we're going to plant these seeds along the garage and nobody else knows. And then when they start to bloom, we'll say surprise. And it'll be our secret until they start to grow. And so when she died at 6, I wasn't old enough to comprehend what death meant yet. All I heard was that she went to heaven, but that she wasn't coming home was too much for me to conceive. But the only thing that I was obsessed with is what do I do with the lilac seeds? You know, that was a secret we had. Do I tell anybody? And it was such a symbol of my life in that she planted these beautiful seeds in me. And I know she knew, but someday those seeds would bloom and I would come out and I would say, surprise.
Oh, do you think you're talking about being gay?
Yes.
Do you think she knew?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Huh. I mean, I think that's why she protected me so much. And when I was afraid to go to school, she would take me to school. And she like I said, she was my everything. And so I think she knew. And that was kind of, she didn't mean to symbolize it with the lilac seeds, but to me, that's exactly what it was. Huh. She was planting these beautiful seeds in me. And someday we would say surprise. Huh.
Did you actually plant the seeds?
She planted them and they did eventually grow. Yes.
And so they weren't mowed down. They actually survived.
I don't know that they're still there or not, because we moved from that house a couple of years later. So I'm not quite sure what happened to them. But can I tell you one more story?
Of course.
I'm a huge proponent of synchronicities. To me, that's what a higher power is something that we can't understand that happens. And in 1989 and 90, I was touring the country with an AIDS benefit called Heartstrings. It was a musical that we took to 30 different cities. And it was very difficult for us because we were, you know, the audiences in every city were filled with people who were suffering. Mm. And so it was so much to absorb. And we were sitting on the bus in Indianapolis, ready to move to the next city. And I was waiting for the cast members to come onto the bus. And I was just overwhelmed. And so I got off the bus and walked through a city park, and it was covered in snow. And I walked over to this gazebo and I saw this silver plaque underneath the snow. And I brushed with my glove the snow off of the plaque. You make me cry here. And the plaque said, "Smile, lilacs will bloom here in the spring."
Oh, yeah, that's pretty powerful. Wow.
I can't tell you the number of times throughout my life that my mother has just reappeared for me like that.
Wow. Do you think that she knew she was dying?
I don't know. She'd been sick for quite a while, off and on. She had what was called Addison's disease. But I do know that it was a total shock to my father and everyone when she passed away that night.
So she just was ill and then just passed away, boom, like that?
Yeah. My sister was in bed with her, and she told my sister to go upstairs. And I just talked to my sister yesterday about this. And she said she was leaving the bedroom and she heard mom take a deep breath. And she said, I'm convinced that was her last one.
So. Wow. And is that your older sister?
Yes. Mm-hmm. There's five of us and she's the oldest. But I will tell you another blessing that came from mom's death was the five of us are as close as you can possibly imagine. We're best friends. And I know that came from all of us struggling together after she died.
Right.
But we still once a year, when my father died, he left money for us to meet once a year and get together and laugh and sing and tell stories from our childhood. And we're best friends.
So that was his purpose in leaving that you would get together?
Yes, it was. Yeah. He started a company and made us board of directors. So we have to meet once a year as the board of directors.
Oh.
and we pick a big farmhouse somewhere in the Midwest always and all get together and no siblings or spouses, just the five of us.
That's very cool. When did your father die?
He died in 2007. So
okay. So you're in Palm Springs now?
Yes. Been here 2 years yesterday.
And what brought you here?
Every year that ends in zero, I made a major move in my life. So in 1980, 1990, 2000, I always made a major move. And so I knew that in 2020, I was going to do a major move. And then COVID hit and kind of made everybody make major changes. I never really thought Palm Springs was going to be the place. My brother is a Catholic priest, and I asked him if he would move here with me when I retired. And he laughed and said, "I've spent my whole life keeping people out of hell. Why would I want to live there?"
Was he referring to the heat or the community?
The heat. No, he's referring to the heat.
Okay.
He would love the community. But
now is he gay or straight?
Am I allowed to say that on here? I shouldn't say.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, the question.
We'll let him do the next podcast.
All right. That's cool. All right. So what's it been like living in Palm Springs for you?
I tell you, it's a great community. It really is. It's during COVID was a little difficult because everybody was in quarantine and I felt a little bit alone. And I actually one day decided I was going to start a monthly group for people who were new to Palm Springs, and it kind of exploded and ended up, we were going to be at the convention center and all these companies wanted to host it and all that. But then because of COVID, we couldn't do it. So,
wow.
It actually gave me the gift of meeting several people in trying to start that event. So it ended up doing for me what I had hoped it would do. But since then, I've made some great friends here.
Did you ever have the meeting at the convention?
No, we didn't.
So it wasn't just postponed until after COVID.
It was postponed, but we haven't really gotten back to doing it yet. So it's something I'd still like to do. Because
do you still feel like you're new here, or are you in the mentoring new people mode?
No, I'm not there yet. Although I would sure like to, because again, the gift of feeling that loneliness when I moved here gives me such compassion for people who are new here, new here and need to meet people. And there are a lot of groups. There's single groups and people groups that mingle and get together for cocktails and things. So there are
some. Was this a gay group you were doing, or just
it started out that way? At first it was called the New Meet and Greet, and New Meet was in quotes. But then when it got bigger and bigger, the convention center said, no, we can't call it that. So then it was just Welcome to Palm Springs. And so it was any more than we would not want to be excluded. There was no way I wanted to exclude anyone else who was new to the city.
Right.
And if indeed we were going to learn about culture and history and restaurants and all the different things that there are to learn here, so many great museums and art shows and all that kind of thing, why not open it up to everybody?
What's been the hardest thing living here?
I would say the heat. I'm still learning to adapt to that. And everybody says, oh, you get used to it, but not quite there yet. And I miss Los Angeles. It was a big, vibrant city, and I loved living. I was there 25 years, and I loved it. So I do miss parts of LA, but to be honest, in the 2 years, I've only been back once.
So you must not miss it that much.
I don't miss it that much, right.
Well, it was really fun because I went to this, the two guys that you met as you came to do the podcast, my two Airbnb guests were on the way out, and they were here for their friend was doing an installation at the Palm Springs Art Museum.
Oh, wow.
And it was pretty fabulous. But I kept saying to them last night, because I tagged along and went to it. And it was like, I kept looking around at him. I said, this is not a Palm Springs crowd.
No.
Because it was, I'd say millennials up through maybe 40s. I mean, there were some other people there, obviously, but dressed very LA, let's just say that way. And I mean, everybody was so creative and just these outrageous hairdos and braided beards and everything. And it reminded me of the art scene in Seattle, like way back when. It was very cool. I liked it. But definitely not Palm Springs, but they brought LA to Palm Springs definitely for that show last night.
I used to love the art shows in Seattle. It was a great community up there.
Yeah, it was really fun. Well, so here we are. Any final thoughts for the listeners? And well, if they want to contact you, may we put some way of doing that in the episode notes?
Absolutely. I can put
we'll do that.
I have a website.
Okay. Any final thoughts?
No, unless you have any final questions.
Probably not. I think I've pretty well covered it, but are you a top or a bottom? I'm going to cut that out.
And I'm not going to answer it.
Okay. Thanks for coming in, and it's been fun.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye.